Criminal Justice Oversight Council will come to order. Ms. Songer, will you please take roll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Patelis?
Excused.
Senator Friedel?
Here.
Senator Lynch?
Here.
Representative Smith?
Here.
Judge McCarthy?
Here.
Judge Berger?
Here.
Melissa Kelly?
Here.
Director Shendelson?
Excused.
Director Brereton?
Excused.
Aldina Berdonbach?
Here.
Sheriff Kanan?
Excused.
Alan Doan?
Here.
Amy Tenney?
Here.
Director Goodkin?
Here.
Sharon Kickenwoman?
Here.
Scott Twido?
Here.
And Chair Regeer?
Here. Good morning, Council. I am going to let Ms. Weiss introduce some new staff. We've had a staff change again with the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Council members. So I guess I'll introduce myself again. I was here last meeting just really briefly, but I'm Rachel Weiss. I'm the Research Director at the Legislative Services Division. And it is my great pleasure to introduce you to Laura Shirley, who is our newest research analyst. She might not be a stranger to you, though. She has worked with us for, I think, going on nine years, and has really earned her way into being our newest analyst. She'll be assigned to you, and she actually can hit the ground running because she has worked with law and justice in the past, including this interim. So she is actually pretty conversational with a lot of the issues that you'll be working on. She'll be your main staff, your main contact for the Criminal Justice Oversight Council. I'll be helping out with some of the transition and then also with the SB 11 data warehouse oversight, given a little bit of familiarity with that from last interim. But in the end, Laura will be your main contact for anything council related. Happy to answer any questions, or back to you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, and welcome, Ms. Shirley. Does anyone have questions? All right, we will move on and dive into our next agenda item, the review of the pre-sentence investigation statutes. And we have online from the Crime and Justice Institute a presentation, and I will turn it over to them.
Good morning, thank you, Madam Chair. We are really excited to be back. Thank you for having us back before the CJOC to discuss some information around pre-sentence investigations and the sentencing process, both in Montana and in other states.
Valerie, I'm going to interrupt here. You guys begin to speak, if you would introduce yourselves.
Absolutely. Valerie Mead with the Crime and Justice Institute. I am a deputy director, and I'll have Caitlin introduce herself briefly, but then also when she starts to speak.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks, Val. My name is Caitlin Flood. I'm a senior policy specialist with the Crime and Justice Institute. Thank you again for having us, and I'll turn it back to you, Val.
Okay. So just a little bit about CJI. Again, Crime and Justice Institute is a Boston-based organization. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit consulting policy analysis. We do research services, training, and implementation support to improve public safety in communities throughout the country. We see our expertise as bridging the gap between research and practice on the ground with the goal of helping jurisdictions adopt transformative improvement to their adult and youth justice systems. Specifically, our team has been working in Montana alongside Montana's Department of Corrections after engaging in a revocation analysis, and we're now working alongside DOC leadership and some work groups to implement some of the recommendations from that analysis. We just did introductions, but here's a slide that just shows who we are. Again, my name's Valerie Mead, Deputy Director. Caitlin Flood is with me today, Senior Policy Specialist. Brian McLaughlin is a Policy Specialist who's joining us virtually. The three of us are part of a bigger CGI team that's been working in Montana to support your initiatives. We're pleased to be with you today. So just a little bit about what we'll go through. We'd like to start by giving a quick refresher of why we've been asked by CJOC to address the topic of pre-sentence investigations as part of a larger sentencing conversation. When we last presented to CJOC, we discussed a bit about the current conditions work group, then the work that they're doing in addressing conditions of supervision within and related to the PSI as well. Judge Berger also presented in January on judicial perspectives related to the role of the PSI. From there, you all discussed prioritizing conversations around the PSI to learn more about how other states are handling the PSI process and getting information to judges in time for sentencing. We were asked by DOC to do some follow-up research about state practices that may serve as examples of alternatives to PSI frameworks and to continue the conversation around the role of PSI within sentencing. So today's conversation is meant to supplement that discussion, and we're happy to follow up on any areas of interest. So we'll begin with reviewing the outline and outlining the purpose of PSIs, then give a quick refresher on Montana's PSI statute and some of the questions CJOC raised about other state PSI practices. And then we'll turn to some higher level themes from our 50 state review of PSI statutes and any trends that we can identify. We'll then focus on a handful of states that have some unique PSI practices that this group might be interested in. And finally, we'll open the conversation to any questions and thoughts that you all might have. So let's start with the definition and purpose of a PSI. As was described briefly at the last meeting, PSIs are reports that are meant to provide information to the court on the defendant's personal history and criminal conduct to promote individualized sentencing. As we have seen, these reports follow people throughout their trajectory in the criminal justice system, and therefore do not only inform the current system or sentence, but also impact future decisions that courts, prisons, supervision agencies make down the road. PSI was intended to promote individualized sentencing by giving information specific to the individual's potential for rehabilitation and community reintegration and allow judges to tailor their sentences accordingly. In many jurisdictions, staff from the court or probation agency complete PSIs before the sentencing date. So then we'll turn to, while a critical document at sentencing, we also know that the PSI follows the individual throughout different decision points during their justice involvement. Here are a few examples of decision makers apart from judges who also use PSIs. So case managers will use the document to consider the severity of the offense when making treatment programming or discharge planning decisions. Counselors will use the document to determine who can visit an individual while they're in a custodial setting. Programming administrators will use a PSI to determine whether an individual is required to participate in programming. Case managers will turn to a PSI to determine whether an individual is eligible for beneficial programs and benefit eligibility such as SSI or SSD. Medical personnel will turn to the PSI to determine whether the individual merits medical attention. And then additionally, the Board of Pardons and Parole and probation officers often use the PSI to inform case plans and beneficial conditions of supervision. We want to first outline the guidance in Montana statutes related to PSIs, both when PSIs are required to be submitted to the court and what the content makes up the PSI. So the PSI statute requires that only certain categories of information, including the defendant's social and criminal history, current offense, behavioral health background, employment, and education. But statutory language also includes a much more comprehensive list of optional evaluations depending on the individual's circumstances. This could be one reason why content within PSIs varies across the state and why there's differences in whether PSIs are ordered in the first place. At the last meeting, CJOC discussed the possibility of improving the process for PSIs as part of sentencing. We learned that CJOC is interested in these categories and what other states do as part of sentencing practice. So the group discussed whether it was possible to tailor PSIs to the offense, creating a short form for lesser offenses, introducing more consistency between regencies when ordering PSIs, learning about what kinds of assessments different states include in the PSI process, and the length of time for PSI writers to complete their reports in different jurisdictions. This group also discussed briefly some factors outside the PSI process, including the addition of contracted PSI writers who can do a deeper dive in researching an individual's background. CJI used these questions as areas of interest to inform our state review, which we'll turn to now. CJI did a review of each state's PSI statutory language. It's important to note here that not all information related to a PSI is always listed within the PSI statute, and the practices around PSI creation are also often within court or supervision agency policy and not in statute. So in reviewing the state PSI statutes, we focused on four categories. First, whether the statute contained language about a specific offense category or offenses triggering PSIs, about unique information to be included within the PSI outside of typical content, whether certain assessments were required to be part of the PSI report, and then finally, timeline for development of the PSI. So moving into themes, we'll walk through some of the highlights from themes we found across the PSI statutes. Related to circumstances triggering PSIs, there are 30 states that require PSIs to be completed for felony or a serious misdemeanor. In looking at categories of PSI content, we saw most PSIs required similar information across jurisdictions. Where states varied in terms of PSI content related to requiring certain assessments or findings to be included within the PSI. And then finally, in looking at timelines related to PSI completion, we also found states varied in, one, the timelines for PSI development, and then, two, how much notice the court needed to receive and review the PSI. So let's dive into that. First, as I said, there are 30 states that order PSIs on felony or serious misdemeanors. This reflects trends that PSIs are generally ordered in cases where prison is a potential sentence. There are 9 states that order PSIs regardless of underlying charges, which promotes some level of consistency, but also has consequences for capacity of the court and PSI writers. And then there are states like Illinois that explicitly carve out exceptions for the general rule about when PSIs need to be ordered. In Illinois, the exception to the PSI requirement is where parties agree to an imposing specific sentence, such that additional information typically available in the PSI is seen as less necessary. So then we'll move to content. PSIs tend to collect similar information across each of the states. Some of that information is prior criminal history, known criminal affiliations, circumstances of the offense, victim impact, financial, social, and psychological status of the defendant, prior psychological evaluations, and family marital situation. In this way, the PSI focuses on prior circumstances leading to the offense in both the defendant and the victim's current status. These are the categories that have been deemed most relevant when the judge is imposing the sentence and paint a fuller picture of the person before the court and the consequences of the crime. As you'll see, this list aligns with Montana's PSI guidance. Excuse me. In addition to the common categories required in most PSIs, some states tailor information requirements for the PSI, including in Vermont, where the PSI statute requires specific treatment recommendations where a treatment assessment has been ordered, which is often tied to the underlying offense. In Washington State, anyone with an underlying drug offense automatically gets a substance use evaluation. In New Jersey, the PSI statute requires documentation around whether previous civil commitments were ordered. In Idaho, PSIs must include past psychological evaluations. And in Montana and Wyoming, it requires that recommendations made in the PSI propose the least restrictive environment. We know that the completion of more detailed assessments can also take time, but they can add a great deal of information for the court's consideration when imposing a sentence. 10 states PSI, excuse me, 10 states PSI statutes mention circumstances requiring mental health and or physical evaluations known as biopsychosocial assessments. 17 states PSI statutes specifically reference risk need responsivity assessments as part of the PSI process. Specifically, 2 states have built risk assessments specifically to sentencing decisions. Virginia was the first state to adopt a risk assessment statewide, which started as a tool to identify the percentage of the lowest risk incarceration-bound individuals convicted of drug and property crimes to divert people from 2 alternative sentences. Virginia's commission has also built out a sex offender risk assessment tool. The Sentencing Commission has created a series of worksheets that guide the user through the at sentencing risk assessment process. The presence of a relevant risk factor corresponds to a certain number of points, and then that total number of points is compared to a threshold printed on the worksheet. If the individual meets the threshold, either for recommending diversion or increased high-end sentence, that information is transferred to the main sentencing guidelines worksheet for judicial consideration as part of the PSI. Another example is Pennsylvania. In 2010, the Pennsylvania Sentencing Commission was directed to develop a risk assessment instrument for use specifically at the time of sentencing. This risk assessment is used as an aid in evaluating the relative risk for an individual will reoffend or pose a threat to society, indicating if more assessment is necessary or if a pre-sentence investigation report should be completed, and determining if an individual is appropriate candidate for an alternative sentence. So next, looking at timelines, in reviewing PSI statutes to see where there was language related to timeline, states consider balancing the need to extend the time it takes to complete the PSI with the due process rights of the defendant, especially in situations where the defendant is incarcerated. Montana is one of the few states that had a requirement for PSIs to be completed within 30 days from the date of the plea or conviction. On the outside range, for those that did have a time frame listed, was Louisiana, which allows for 60 days to complete the PSI. Other jurisdictions instead give advice on how much notice the court needs to review the PSI before the sentencing date, ranging from 10 days before sentence to 48 hours before the sentencing hearing. Some states, such as Missouri and Mississippi, have PSI statutes that provide less specific guidance requiring the PSI submission to the court within a reasonable amount of time, end quotes. Depending on the charges and the other defendant's specific circumstances, such as underlying mental health or substance use issues, requiring a more formal evaluation, timelines are sometimes expanded to ensure an accurate and robust report. Some jurisdictions also allow for extended time where the individual contests part of the PSI. So now we'll look at some state examples of PSI frameworks that might be of interest to Montana. I'm going to turn you over to Caitlin.
Thanks so much, Val, and good morning, everybody. Thank you again for having us back. So as we can see, PSIs are part of the sentencing puzzle and are an important mechanism for getting information to the main decision maker, the judge. We know that many obstacles to sentencing involve getting accurate information to judges in a more timely manner. So today we're hoping to share some examples of how states have tried to streamline this information to judges to advance the sentencing process. So as Val mentioned, you all gave feedback during the January meeting related to some of the challenges in the sentencing process, which include getting the most accurate and comprehensive information to judges at the time of sentencing without further delaying the sentencing process, especially for those who are incarcerated. This group also flagged the somewhat inconsistency with ordering PSIs or the quality of content within PSIs across different parts of the state. So we've looked for some examples of how states have worked to get information to decision makers in an efficient way and streamlining recommendations for judges based on individuals' needs. So we're going to spend the next few minutes highlighting a few state examples of getting information to different justice system practitioners that inform where resources should be expended. So some of these solutions include tiered PSIs based on underlying offenses or how recently the last PSI was completed, legislation that requires training for judges on how to use the information within PSIs, and clear guidance where PSIs are not required, incorporating electronic updates from risk assessments that allow for more efficient updates to the PSI, and then finally, legislation that guides judges on circumstances triggering behavioral health treatment and different sentencing alternatives. So our first example here is Hennepin County, Minnesota, which has a true tiered PSI system. And when we refer to a tiered system, we mean that a PSI will contain information based on underlying offenses or the circumstances of the case, such that there are different expectations for what's included in different PSIs. Before getting into the logistics, we'll take a step back to review how Hennepin County landed on this process. So the problem that Hennepin County faced was an increasingly higher number of cases with PSI writers who were maxed out on their capacity and limited budget options to hire more PSI writers. Hennepin's solution was developed by a work group of judges, defenders, prosecutors, and court staff, specifically their felony investigation unit, and where they met for a few months to discuss what this system should look like and came to reach consensus. The process that this work group landed on allows for lower tier offenses to have briefer or less resource intensive PSIs. And it's important to note here that this tiered system did not require additional legislation and instead was built out as administrative guidance for court practitioners. So each agency representative that participated in the work group brought the concept of this model back to their respective departments and acted as champions for this change. The court's felony investigation unit also took the lead in building out a training for all practitioners that would be using this new tiered PSI system so that users would be cross-trained and any issues were worked out by all practitioners in one shared space. This unit put together a PSI academy to ensure fidelity to this new system. Interestingly, in 2023, Minnesota legislation also put caps on probation sentence terms to limit those probation terms to 5 years, whereas previously probation terms could be as long as the potential maximum sentence of the underlying offense. Stakeholders that we spoke with shared that this also provided some additional guidance to judges and allows for some better calibration within sentences to community supervision. So here we share the Minnesota PSI statutory language to show that this statute did not explicitly outline a path for this tiered system, but there's also nothing that prevents its practice within the statutory language. We learned, and you'll see further details from the attachment that we shared on Hennepin's PSI tiers, that Tier 1 and Tier 2 cases are typically assigned in two scenarios. The first, where someone is being sentenced to probation and there's not intensive or treatment-heavy conditions of supervision assigned. Or secondly, where someone is being sentenced to prison and the only information that's needed is related to jail credits or time served. So this was interesting to us in that shorter, lesser detailed PSIs are not limited to only low-level probation cases, but similar levels of PSI information was deemed appropriate where all the parties were in agreement on the sentence and not much more detailed was required. Additionally, risk and need assessments are included only in Tier 3 and 4 PSIs, where there is information needed about what programming might be most appropriate on supervision sentences or what's most appropriate for more serious underlying offenses. You'll see Tier 4 PSIs include all post-verdict cases, and this is meant to paint a fuller picture for the judge about the individual's level of remorse or accountability in the cases where there was no plea. So this fuller PSI is really meant to obtain more information from the defendant from his or her perspective to outline potential mitigating factors. We learned in speaking with Hennepin stakeholders that the tiers act as building blocks of information such that the selection of a higher tier includes the details of lesser tiers. So, for example, if a judge were to choose a Tier 3 PSI, that report will also include information related to Tiers 1 and 2. So while this tiered system has been implemented in only Hennepin County, there is nothing preventing kind of statewide replication or expansion. And we're next going to turn to a statewide example of a different type of tiered system. So in Connecticut, there is a statewide version of tiered PSIs that are determined by the date of the last completed PSI. So the decision by the court to order a short PSI form has less to do with the type of offense and rather is impacted by the recency of the last known PSI. And if a PSI was completed in the last 5 years, the short form PSI suffices. The long form PSI includes more information, including employment, housing, family background, and behavioral health history. In Connecticut, if a PSI is ordered, but it's understood that the defendant will receive probation and not incarceration, a brief plan for community supervision is completed as part of the PSI process. And this plan focuses on information related to treatment programming, housing, and other resources needed to support supervision, rather than time spent on more detailed social histories. If the supervising officer believes that the defendant is not appropriate for community supervision, this can also be included in the plan as well. This type of tiered PSI is also not based on any legislative language or legislative changes that Connecticut had to make, and rather is a judicial branch court policy providing guidance to courts and the probation division. So overall, what we found is while tiered PSIs are not a very common practice, Hennepin and Connecticut were two examples of tiered PSI systems that operate differently, but both aim to achieve efficiency and information gathering for the court. Another interesting sentencing response that we wanted to share that tries to get the most relevant information to the judge and relevant resources to the defendant comes from legislation in Kansas. SB 123 provides a mandatory assessment and treatment to those who are eligible for the program. This initiative was originally born out of a lack of prison bed space and the recognition that too many people were being sentenced to prison when they really needed drug and alcohol treatment. So the legislature outlined guidance for judges who are sentencing individuals presenting with substance use issues. And this sentencing track was developed to avoid typical challenges related to incomplete treatment referrals or long wait lists, since both the assessment process and subsequent treatment are court ordered. And what we find exciting about SB 123 is that while it started about 20 years ago with somewhat limited eligibility, mainly revolving around drug possession charges, the eligibility criteria has since expanded to include some distribution cases. And then more recently, the legislation includes theft or burglary cases connected to substance use, thereby kind of embracing the spirit of the legislation, which is meant to prioritize getting people connected to treatment resources where their underlying criminal involvement is spurred by drug use. In terms of implementation of this legislation, both treatment providers and court services staff were trained on resources needed to complete assessments and referrals to treatment, as well as training around how providers would be compensated. The substance use assessment is part of the larger PSI process and ensures that the individual meets other eligibility criteria, including scoring high on substance use screeners. Once this assessment confirms eligibility and amenability to treatment programming, the person is then sentenced and entitled to at least 18 months of treatment. Interestingly, it's the Kansas Sentencing Commission who oversees this entire assessment, referral, and the communications between providers and the court. And the Sentencing Commission contracts with certain behavioral health providers who are expected to keep community correction officers and the court updated on participant progress. This ensures consistency of the legislation SB 123 across the state, even as eligibility is expanded and additional treatment providers are added to the network. In a somewhat similar vein related to treatment as a sentencing alternative, Washington State looked to create a sentencing response specific to mental health, since there were gaps in referrals to quality mental health treatment across the state. So in 2021, Washington State passed legislation outlining eligibility criteria, and this sentencing alternative begins with a PSI that includes a treatment and monitoring plan, as well as conditions that align with treatment without putting an undue burden on the individual receiving treatment, really meant to acknowledge responsivity factors as part of this mental health sentencing alternative. The legislation also required collaboration between DOC case managers in facilities and community supervision officers to build this treatment plan, such that the community supervision officers, who are very knowledgeable about community-based resources, are contributing to that initial plan. There's also consideration of victim feedback when building out the individual's plan. Unique to this legislation is the onus put on treatment providers, and through the sentencing process, there's an agreement by the treatment provider to monitor the progress of the defendant through this sentencing alternative and to notify the department and the court if reasonable efforts to engage the individual fail to produce compliance with court-ordered mental health treatment conditions. So together, we see Kansas and Washington State serving as examples for sentencing alternatives where the judge is given sufficient behavioral health information by the time of sentencing to engage in those alternatives. We next looked at Nevada's legislation since it contained some unique aspects related to the use of the PSI. Nevada's PSI statute requires training to be available for all judges, guiding them on how to incorporate information from the PSI within the sentencing process. This training also covers information specific to behavioral health needs or intellectual disabilities and how these factors impact both mitigation and prospects for recovery or program compliance. Nevada, like Illinois, also has some exceptions for the PSIs, either one where a sentence is set by the jury or if the PSI was completed in the last 5 years, similar to Connecticut. And then finally, there's an alternative mechanism in cases where a full PSI is not ordered. In those cases, there's the opportunity for the probation division to complete what they call a general investigation, which covers information most relevant to the person's needs while on community supervision. And this investigation does not need to be completed in time for sentencing and rather supplements information for the supervision officer. We also wanted to highlight a state that gives guidance around the creation of PSIs in light of a serious misdemeanor, as opposed to a felony. So in Iowa, for example, there is statutory guidance that PSIs should be ordered only upon a finding of exceptional circumstances, so where the parties have raised issues requiring additional information. And even in these cases, the information mandated is streamlined, including a more basic history of the defendant and the impact of the offense on the victim. An obstacle that we've heard from Montana stakeholders was the court having access to updated MORA risk and need assessments at the time of sentencing and how helpful this information can be when determining which supervision conditions are most appropriate for the individual. One state that faced a similar challenge and addressed this with some technology upgrades is Indiana. Indiana implemented changes that enhanced the PSI process by ensuring that more of the process was electronic and automated, really allowing for the PSI writer to build on pre-existing information from prior PSIs. Indiana put policies in place to make their risk assessment and PSI electronically connected by allowing the officer to digitally associate a completed risk assessment to the PSI report that they're preparing. Users also have the ability to attach external documents to the PSI, and that can include probable cause affidavits, statements from the defendant, as well as statements from the victim. And this is allowed for more statewide access to PSIs where individuals might have cases across different counties. Before wrapping up, we did want to spend a little bit of time on the role of state sentencing commissions and some of the activities that they engage in that can also be accomplished even where a sentencing commission is not formally developed. So state sentencing commissions have historically developed guidance for courts and practitioners to evaluate sentencing trends and to create resources to give decision makers the most information possible so that sentences are fair and consistent. In some jurisdictions, this has resulted in the development of sentencing guidelines or sentencing grids that outline a sentencing range per offense type. Guidelines are established by looking at sentencing averages by offense type, and then a state sentencing commission norms these sentencing guidelines by determining whether the averages reflect offense severity and what the statute is trying to achieve. So state commissions, such as those in Minnesota, have also developed sentencing worksheets that take these averages for a particular offense and calculates other factors so that the court can weigh these different variables. And as we learned from the Kansas Sentencing Commission, that some commissions even oversee treatment operations for individuals with serious substance use needs, such that commissions have started providing guidance around behavioral health alternatives. Through our review, we also learned that some sentencing commissions have incorporated sentencing averages as a specific section within the PSI to provide judges guidance on general sentencing ranges. We know that CJOC brought up during the January meeting the availability of the DOC sentencing dashboard, which does provide sentencing range averages. So we'll leave this kind of as food for thought about whether within the PSI it might be possible to have a section that lists the sentencing range average for a particular offense, which we know is accessible through this DOC sentencing dashboard. If this was included in the PSIs, judges would not have to rely on parties to submit this as evidence and would not be improper to look outside of the record, which we know was an issue that Judge Berger rightly raised when he presented on PSI's last meeting. And then lastly, we know that the PSI process really contemplates information that judges are getting at the front end before a sentence is imposed. We also heard from CJOC and other practitioners that the PSI is not limited to informing the current sentence, but rather stays with the individual throughout their time in the legal system. So in addition to thinking about sentencing on the front end, states have also considered options to reviewing sentences after the initial sentence has been imposed. So we wanted to outline a few of these initiatives, considering information presented to the court at the back end. So for example, many states and courts have established compassionate release mechanisms where there's a change in circumstance for the defendant for medical emergencies in cases where the individual might not be able to receive the necessary treatment while in custody. Some states are also reconsidering the weight given to criminal history, so assigning different points to felonies depending on severity of the crime and how recent or far in the past those crimes are compared to the current offense. And then courts are also getting additional information about what the individual is accomplishing while in custody, where there are second look review opportunities. And when we reference second look, we mean any hearing that allows the defendant to present positive and productive information about their educational, treatment, and vocational accomplishments while advocating for an earlier release or a placement in a transitional setting in the community. So we share this information really just to highlight how PSIs might be updated over time and play a role in future resentencing decisions. So we hope that this covers some of the questions questions that arose from the meeting in January around what other states were doing when it comes to PSI development. And we'd be more than happy to take any questions or comments that you may have. So thank you so much for your time and for having us again.
Thanks, ladies. Before we jump on to questions, I'll ask for any public comment. Do we have any public comment in the room? Online, if you'd like to leave public comment, please raise your hand. Looks like we have none. All right, questions. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Aguirre. I guess I had a question, and maybe this is designated another time on our agenda, but I was looking at our current statute, and I saw that there was a handout in our folder regarding tiers. Is that current tiers? So it's this, hold on. Tiered PSI and PPI definitions. Is this from a different DOC? Okay.
If I could, yes, Representative Smith. That's from the Hennepin County tiered PSI system.
I had a quick follow-up question on that. Was there a pilot? It's interesting to see a pilot in a county. Was that legislative? Was that something they did on their own, but it was consistent with existing statute? How did they get there?
That's exactly right, Representative. So Hennepin County kind of had more pressing resource needs than other counties in the rest of the state. Put up that screen. But while there was not explicit language within the actual legislation that Minnesota had allowing for a tiered system, they built this out as an administrative policy and something that the court adopted. So they didn't see this as contradictory, but they kind of had a lot of wiggle room to build out a PSI system that was more specific. So in both the Connecticut cases and Hennepin County cases, it wasn't that any legislative change was required, but rather a multidisciplinary work group kind of came together to say, here's a resource issue we're trying to fix. We can do this through a court order and administrative guidance. But yes, the pilot started and then kind of stopped with Hennepin County. And we did ask the question from the stakeholders that we met with, you know, whether or not they envisioned this being replicated across the state. And while the tiered PSI system is working really well for Hennepin County, they felt like this was really kind of born out of a resource crunch, which is a little bit more specific to Hennepin County as opposed to the whole state.
Great. Thank you.
Do we have further questions? Director Gutkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a statement. I want to thank everybody for getting that stuff together so quickly. It's really, really great information. I think it really covers what we tried to talk about at our last meeting with the judge, public defenders, and the county attorney as far as the tiers. I think that's exactly where we were heading. So it's great to see models around the country that are already doing it. Correct me if I'm wrong, Brett or Scott or anyone else, the judge.
Judge Berger.
Madam Chair, I guess just to echo that, I agree. I think that's exactly what we were looking for. And I think we're also still trying to figure out what we're looking for, because I think there's a lot of information that's out there. And it's one of those things of there can be too much information. I mean, you can give a PSI to someone that has just too much information that I go, well, I don't know what I do with all this. I think there's a middle ground in there, and I hope we can really get to that. And I really appreciate the information that we've had going, because I really think we're moving in the right direction of having, whether it's tier level. I think last time Mr. Twido talked about maybe we do it all for just drug cases at one point, but I think we're moving in the right direction with gathering information.
Mr. Chandelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this is a question for the presenters or sort of just the group, but in a situation where we have no determinant sentencing in Montana, would a tiered PSI structure that is using criteria to essentially limit the information a judge is given be a step towards that, whether the judicial branch would enjoy that, being limited in a non-determinant state. Actually, I do have my question. There was filler. I guess for Caitlin and Valerie, how many of the states that had some sort of formal tiered structure are determinant sentencing states? And I apologize, I did join late, so I may have missed that information.
No problem. And so it was only one state and then a county, Hennepin County, in Minnesota. And so Minnesota, to my knowledge, is an indeterminate sentencing state, but they have worked with their sentencing commission to provide sentencing guidelines. And then for Connecticut, I think we would need to circle back because I'm not 100% sure if that is a determinant or indeterminate sentencing state. But we can absolutely provide that information to you.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there, from your work on this particular look or others, any feeling of how judiciaries in indeterminate sentencing states respond to this kind of policy in terms of limiting the information that they may be getting? I see Judge Berger has his hand maybe raised again, so maybe he has his own thoughts too. But
sure.
Thank you.
And just to answer that quickly, and I don't want to speak in overgeneralization since we were really only able to find two jurisdictions that had these tiered PSIs, but from the Hennepin County stakeholders, the response from the bench, their judicial stakeholders, was really very positive in having this tiered information, especially since the requirement in Hennepin County is that all parties have to agree, so they have a majority vote on what tiered level is going to be ordered. So the judge is, you know, not surprised about the type of information that's coming before him or her, and that instead that is decided at a conference with the defender, the judge, and the prosecutor. And we heard, for the most part, you know, consensus is being able to be reached. And where the parties might have disagreements about what level of PSI needs to be ordered, there's often a good deal of information that's coming out even from that administrative conference. So at least in that one case, in the case of Hennepin County, judges did not give pushback in terms of the extent of information they were getting in the PSI because they were part of that decision-making process that determined which tier they were getting. I hope that answers your question.
That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
Judge Berger?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'll just take a step back real quick and apologize. I forgot that Director Channelson wasn't at the last meeting. And we kind of had a long, rambling discussion. If you could imagine that Director Gutkin, myself, and Mr. Twido could have a long, rambling discussion.
Shocking.
Yes, it was. And where we kind of ended was if we were calling it tiers or what we were calling, we had discussed, well, let's look at drug cases, for example, we know what the sentencing limitations are. A lot of first-time drug offenses, 3-year deferred, 2-year deferred. Everyone knows that's what they're going to get. But is it helpful to just give them that without a little bit of information, to know the criminal history, to know if they get a CD eval? So that's where we talked about maybe not so much limiting the information, because there's really not that much information out there for a first-time felon as terms of this. The information is already limited. We're just not getting a PSI because it's so limited, we just haven't decided to do that. And so not to sound argumentative in that saying it's not limiting, we're almost, from my perspective as a judge, I'm not limiting the information because there's only a limited information available. I'm just actually requesting it and having it written down to help later on. So if there is a revocation, PMP, DOC knows what happened. We're not getting a PSI 9 months from now when someone fails and we all act shocked of, wow, why didn't we give them a CD eval? Why didn't we do this? So it's limited information, but only because that's all that'll be available.
For Representative Smith.
That's really helpful, Judge. I guess I have a question for sort of those in the room representing the various key stakeholders, the directors, the judges who are online. I guess my question would be, do you see, from just sort of an operational standpoint of this council. Do you see us pulling together something quickly in the next few months with our analyst to make sort of legislative recommendations? Do you see this small working group that essentially does an overhaul of tiers? I guess, what do you see happening in relation to the Criminal Justice Oversight Council on this issue in the next couple months?
Director Shandleton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I'm really heartened by how much some places have been able to do without legislative action and within existing policy. I think DOC has set some really strong examples of that with their evidence-based bureau and quality assurance. I probably messed that up. But looking to bring evidence-based practices to all aspects of corrections, I think this is another area that, you know, even without legislative action, assuming there were resources available, that, you know, parole and probation could look at this and pilot it themselves with local judiciaries that might be open to it, because we have a very loose sentencing structure that would allow for that. In terms of actually having legislative action, I think that that might be a fairly large lift, given all of the other questions going on and how much change DOC already has. From the defense perspective, and Ms. Berdenwalk is with us as well, our division administrator from the conflict division, I think for our purposes, there might be just as many times we want the judge to have more information than they're getting in a PSI. I don't know specifically which jurisdictions we're doing it, but we are filing sentencing memos in certain jurisdictions in order to supplement the information available to the court to try to give a more holistic look at an individual as the judge considers a sentence in a non-determinate sentencing state, because there is not a lot of information. The judge has a lot of discretion. And so that was really my concern about asking about limiting information to the judge, because we are so frequently, probably just as frequently, wanting to introduce additional information to the court that wouldn't come out through a PSI itself. So, but I think that if there's a willingness at the DOC level and a judiciary in a district that's willing to try something, there's some really low-hanging fruit here, especially with substance use and mental health, that could be approached. And that could be done potentially without legislation.
That's great. I think I heard District Attorney Twito volunteer his county. Since he's not here, we can go ahead and volunteer. Can I ask one follow-up?
Mr. Twito, do you have anything to say about that?
Chair, Yellowstone County
has
been a guinea pig for far too long. So I just have one thought. To follow up on Director Shandleton's comments and maybe the judges, I heard Ms. Flood discuss that some pre-sentence investigative reports contain like sentencing ranges based on the average from a statewide perspective. We often find ourselves writing a sentencing memo, like Director Shandleton discussed, putting that information together for the court. Oftentimes the court in a contested sentencing wants that information, and so we supplement that. If the DOC wants to make that part of the standard practice of putting that in a PSI, I would imagine that both the defense and prosecution would really welcome that as an addition as part of the sentencing investigation.
Ms. Baer, don't walk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my response to Mr. Twito might be not necessarily statewide, but certainly jurisdiction-wide. I think that the sentencing that happens in Yellowstone County obviously differs greatly judge to judge. I'm not sure maybe in some of your other jurisdictions where you have two judges or even one judge that a statewide number is that helpful.
Judge Berger?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a kind of follow-up answer to Representative Smith and then also a comment. When it comes to what we're looking for, what I'm thinking, I'm willing to work with whatever the Department of Corrections is willing to do on this. I think Director Gutkin and I have talked about this. I don't want to overwhelm him. I mean, he's got a huge department. And I think we've even talked where he said, yeah, this would be great, not sure how we make it work. I disagree a little bit with what Director Shandelson said on whether it needs to be legislative or not, only from the fact of if it's legislative, I think it gives the DOC a better ability to react. There's funding there. If it's statutory, I love when the legislature tells me what to do. Write it down. Tell me what to do. Tell me how to follow it. And if you say I need to do a PSI here, then tell it for everyone. Because if we don't do it that way, what's going to happen is, as Ms. Bairdonwalk just said, is that maybe if you're in Beaverhead County, you get a PSI every time on a drug case. Maybe if you're in Silverbow County, it's discretionary, you don't. Should 60 miles differentiate how you're sentenced information-wise? I don't think so. Every case is different. But to get that information, I think the DOC is going to need more tools to work with. So not to argue that with Director Shandelson that we can't do it with what's already there, even though it's a big lift. If DOC is willing to do the lift, I think it would be a great thing to go for.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Go ahead.
So I guess I was thinking, Judge Berger, one of the things that I was looking at is what does it take, or what would it look like for low-hanging fruit that the whole group could agree on? And I'm curious, I guess, for all of you in the room who deal or who are working in courtroom settings and sentencings, am I right when I read the statute that mental health evaluations are a may and not a shall? And what kind of tweaks could happen that could help give courts very clear guidance on that one piece of low-hanging fruit that I think is really common across the board in sentencings? Is there a tweak that you see or others in the room or online see that may be an option?
Ms. Bear, don't walk.
So, and thank you,
pull that Chair. Pull that microphone a little closer so those online can hear you.
I've never been accused of not being able to be heard. I think the may and the shall, though, can be tricky, especially from a defense point, right? There are things that are perfectly fine in that plea agreement that get us to where we all need to go without putting everybody's thing out on the street. And often when we do preliminary, we as the public defender's office actually often do mental health evals. We pay for a lot of mental health evals. We pay for a lot of CD evals as part of a plea agreement option. So it gives me a little bit of heartburn to say shall with mental health evals, but it is a little bit easier lift. It also, we tend to submit those evals to the court under seal that follow them. I'm learning lately that maybe they're not following them as well when they go into DOC. We think their CD evals are going with them when we file them under seal, and maybe they're not, or their mental health evals are not. So there definitely are things we want, but also are careful about what we submit to a court.
Director Shandelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two points. One, thank you, Judge Berger. I do absolutely understand and appreciate that perspective. And I want to just clarify, I didn't mean to say the legislation couldn't or shouldn't be pursued, but there may be low-hanging fruit that DOC could do on its own to reduce not just its own workload, but provide the judge with an appropriate level of expectations. I think I've heard representatives from DOC say several times, we want people in the right beds for the right amount of time. And I think that same kind of approach here could, you know, we don't need to inundate the court with information nor deprive them of important information. So thank you for that opportunity, Judge Berger. And I think you're definitely right in the bigger picture legislation. And so in terms of your question, Representative Smith, what is something maybe even this body could do could be to look at some of these low-hanging fruit things like mental health, substance use addiction, or use disorder, and see, are there standard things that could go statewide that would have the buy-in from DOC and the courts, from the defense and prosecution? These are appropriate steps in every case that meets these criteria. The problem is, if that door is opened, then I think it's going to invite discussion into the whole sentencing structure and where that discretion should be. And that seems like it could potentially delay getting to a result, just because it's been the way it's been for a while in terms of non-determinant sentencing and the discretion of the judge. And I don't know that there's any real interest to change that. But opening that hand could potentially lead down to, well, if judges need this kind of information, what else do they need and what do they need it for? And get into, well, really what we want is a determinant sentencing structure. And I'm not sure that any stakeholder really wants to tackle that, nor am I at this point saying that's what I want either, for what it's worth. But I think there probably would be low-hanging fruit that we could get consensus on. Mental health, substance use addiction as part of a pre-sentence structure. There's already, as Judge Berger identified, certain mandatory or strongly needed wording in the language regarding drug convictions and the deferred sentences that are going to come out of that. And that is well-taken information that he may not need that if the determinant sentencing in that case is almost always going to be a deferred. So maybe there is an opportunity for a council sort of bill that, you know, we have all the stakeholders here, that the legislative members such as yourself could take forward as an opportunity. I just didn't want to... I think there's still things that if there's resources and totally within Director Gookin's department decides, there may be things they could do or at least try without it. And, you know, we would help in the only way we could too.
Well, I, oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I appreciate both of the comments because I think about how you could craft language that would create an exception so that we don't trap the parties in a space that they're unable to reach that plea agreement. So you could do some exception language. Something that I think about in relation to sort of the idea of, and I'm interested to hear what you say, what sort of your take on it. I'm interested in that idea of a very narrow piece of legislation that is really targeted to those subject matters and those evals. And I guess where I'm thinking from Director Gookin's perspective is what could it look like to include an appropriation for the contract writers so that you have the resources to do it? So anyway, thinking out loud.
Any further discussion? Director Gookin?
Madam Chair, yes. I appreciate all the conversation. I think rewinding and going back a couple of meetings, I think the reason why we brought this up is because of the past legislation and the time limits on the PSIs and the product that the judges and the attorneys were getting because of that legislation. So I would just argue that let's keep our eye on the ball, and we want to be as efficient as possible with our probation officers and our PSI writers and provide a quality PSI to everyone involved. However, I think what we heard today is it's not all one package. So I think that's the thing that we have to really focus on, because I agree that I believe we can do some things within our department and working locally to be able to, and I think he called it low-hanging fruit, to be able to be more efficient before we start asking for more bodies, because that's the way we do things. We try to be as efficient as possible before we go to the legislature and ask, because we have to justify it instead of just saying we need 20 more PSI writers because we're going to do this level of PSI for everyone. I hope that makes sense.
Any further questions or discussion? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Flood and Ms. Mead.
Thank you all so much. And just wanted to confirm that Connecticut is an indeterminate sentencing state. We just were able to confirm that during the conversation. So thank you again for having us.
Thank you. All right, moving on to our next agenda item, Department of Corrections update. Are we ready to do that? Is Mr. Ray? Yeah, okay. I will turn it over to Director Gootkin and Superintendent Ray.
Madam Chair and yes. Members of the committee, this is Superintendent Steve Ray out of Pine Hills, and he will be doing the presentation for us.
There we are. Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Ray, last name is spelled R-A-Y. I'm the superintendent of the Pine Hills Correctional Facility. I've been there for 14 years. Prior to that, I worked at the Glendive Regional Prison as a warden there for 5 years, worked in the North Dakota Women's Prison for a while, and also started my career in a maximum security federally contracted juvenile facility. So, Montana Department of Corrections manages its youth population am a male youth population in Pine Hills. We have approximately 30 youth and 80 adults in the facility. Two of the housing units are dedicated to youth, one a dedicated sex offender treatment unit, and a second one a general housing unit. We have three units of adult jail holds and then one unit of young adult treatment program. It's a specialized program where we pull 18 to 24-year-olds out that are brand new to the system and give them vocational training, treatment training, and also GED if they need it. So our youth flow system, I put a chart together just to kind of show the committee how it works. Kids out in the community start with juvenile probation. The probation officers work to intervene with the kids, try to do different types of diversion. At some point in time, they're formally adjudicated and then sent to Pine Hills, and that's the blue part. That's the part that we deal with. When you look at the whole system, the kids that come in that are interact with juvenile probation, only about 1% of them end up in Pine Hills. And so if 3,000 kids start out the system, we see about 30 of them. So the Montana does a very good job of diverting those types of kids and keeping them out of the system. When kids do come in, we do a comprehensive evaluation. We use the Ohio Youth Assessment. It's a tool that we use that comes from the University of Cincinnati to build a case plan. With that case plan, we set a length of stay. The kids then work on their treatment plan. When they successfully complete their treatment plan, then they're ready for release. So we're seeing, I put together a chart on some of our population trends, and you can see back in 2014, Montana started to really trend down in the population of youth that were coming into the system. In 2021, we saw a bump that started to bring it back up, and that trend of youth going down was a national trend. A lot of states saw that. I think we spent a lot of money on early intervention in the community. That was working. And so the next slide, we wanted to look at why is Montana seeing that bump or what's happening. And so we did a side-by-side comparison of 2020-2023. And you can see that in 2020, we didn't have a lot of criminally convicted youth. Criminally convicted youth are kids that are being charged as adults. That was pretty rare. We'd see one or two a year, generally in Pine Hills. You can see last year we had seven. So we pulled out the data on assault with weapons. That was a fairly rare thing prior to 2023. You can now see that there's quite a few, and already in 2024 we're starting to see a lot of that as well. And then youth charged with homicide. I think in my 14 years, I've maybe seen two kids charged with homicide, and this year we have eight kids on the books coming in being charged with homicide. So we're also starting to see more serious gang and gang affiliation. Currently in Pine Hills, we have four different gangs, Norteños, Sierreños, we have Bloods, and then a Parkway gang. So with gangs, obviously, it starts to cause issues with housing. Those kids preying on other kids coming from other communities, and obviously violence, drugs, things like that. So that's making a little bit more of a challenge. When we break down our population, 11% are wards of the state are under the care and custody of DPPHS, 57% on psychotropic medication, and 55% are Native American. And the Native American population, generally, the other two are pretty much the same. We'll see 50 to 70% on some kind of medication, kids coming into Pine Hills. The Native American population generally runs around 25%, so this is a high number for us. A lot of the kids coming in are young Native American kids over the last year. So that's been a challenge. The Department of Corrections is working. We have a Native American liaison that we have on board. He's working with the tribes to make sure we bring elders in. We have a pretty good Native American program. It got stunted a little bit during COVID. Some of our elders died, but we have sweats. We bring the medicine wheel in. And so we are trying to beef that up with the number of Native American kids coming in, trying to make sure we're doing some kind of healing through culture and having programs that address some of that challenge. So we also, Pine Hills also oversees the female youth. The female youth are housed in five C's across the border in Idaho. This is their daily population. I pulled this. This is since we closed Riverside. In 2017, we closed Riverside. We were running one or two girls at a time. Of course, it immediately spiked as soon as we did that. And then it's pretty much came down and leveled out around two or three girls. We are seeing more violent crimes from the girls. Over the last couple of years, we're starting to see some more serious assaults. The same things, I think, happening with the boys. So we do, Pine Hills is involved in all of their tri-mate treatment. So we aren't just putting the girls over into 5Cs. We're involved in their length of stay. We have monthly meetings with them. Our treatment people are meeting with them. We go over and visit the girls once a year, talk to the girls. Our staff at Pine Hills are also meeting with the girls monthly through a television net and keeping progress, keeping track of their progress, and also asking if they have any questions or any problems. The girls do pretty good there. A lot of states have trouble with that population of girls. Down in 5Cs, I think they have girls from South Dakota. I think some girls from North Dakota, Wyoming. There's just a small number that states are struggling to figure out what do you do with two or three girls and how do you house them. And 5Cs serves two or three different states, and it seems like it's been a pretty good answer for us. So the Montana Department of Corrections monitors itself internally using performance-based standards. And performance-based standards is a nationally recognized performance model that gives us a data-driven approach. It helps us, using research, understand how we interact. It compares us to other states. It also gives us the ability to measure and track key indicators of performance. We compare with similar participants across the country. We use research and best practice to guide our improvement and accountability and transparency through high-quality standardized national data. And so all the blue states on that chart are states that are involved in performance-based standards. And so when we collect data every April and October, we collect a ton of data inside our facility. Performance-based standards, we enter it into a computer system, and then it starts to, it'll bring a chart, which I'll show you in a sec. The chart just shows what states we're gonna compare ourselves to here in a minute. So performance-based standards, uses a cycle. So what we do is we do a report, we collect data, we take a look at the data, we analyze what's going on, and then we work on a facility improvement plan. So if there's anything out of whack or not in the system that we can see is obvious, we can work on improving that. One of the things we really try to track is the use of restraints, confinement, and those types of things. And so this is what a PBS chart looks like. The red line is what that national average, those 30 states, look like. The blue line is what Pine Hills is. Research shows that when you use physical restraints in a correctional facility, or generally you have more injuries to staff, more injuries to kids, there's more violence, there's more confinement. So tracking this helps us monitor all those things. If you aren't using confinement, if you aren't having to physically restrain kids, generally it leads to a better outcome, especially with treatment of kids. So you can see that works significantly low. We also monitor mechanical restraints. When we have instances of youth misbehavior, we don't always have to put handcuffs on kids. So we're training our staff using nonviolent crisis intervention training, things like that, that, you know, when we're having an interaction with a kid, you don't have to, if he doesn't need to have restraints put on him, he doesn't get restraints put on him. So we monitor that as well. Research shows the same things as physical restraints generally have a better facility. You can build a relationship with a kid and a safer facility if you don't use mechanical restraints. At the same time, we still encourage our officers, you know, if they have to use mechanical restraints for their safety, to do that. So Pine Hills doesn't use any pepper spray or OC, so we do track that internally. If there was an incident where there was a kid with a weapon or a staff was going to get hurt, we would authorize use of it. We just don't use it. It's hard to build relationships with kids if you're spraying them in the face with that. We also don't use restraint chairs or restraint beds. So that's a chart that's kind of showing that. The other thing we do with PBS is we also interview the youth. The youth are given a tablet. It's they're confidential. They're put in there, and so then we ask the kids the questions. And so the questions we ask the kids, and remember, these are the 30 toughest kids, have been kicked out of all the schools. So it's always interesting to see what they do. Do staff use force only when they really need to? The kids are saying, you know, around 70% of the time, yes. and 20% of the time sometimes. And so it's another way for us to self kind of monitor ourselves by, you know, going through and seeing the data, but then also asking the kids, hey, are we doing a good job? And so the kids there are saying we are. The other thing we monitor is the isolation in room confinement. Pine Hills, the state changed the law. Pine Hills and the Montana Department of Corrections changed their policy. We do not use disciplinary or confinement. So if a kid gets in a fight with another kid, a disciplinary officer can't come in and lock him down, saying you get 3 days in your room or anything like that. We use confinement assessment review team. So it's a CART team. An example of that is two kids get into a fight. They both get sent to the room just like they would anywhere. Within 15 minutes, officers are down the hall talking to the kids. And the kids, when they're ready to and they've calmed down enough, they're brought out and have to sit next to each other and work their differences out. When they're able to resolve their differences, they get to come out of their room. So this is a tracking of that. If a kid put in his room for more than 15 minutes, we consider that isolation or room confinement. And so anytime a kid's put in his room, as soon as 15 minutes happens and he can't come out of his room, we consider that an incident. And so you can see what that 30-state average is, and that we're, Pine Hills is well below that in using isolation or room confinement to control behavior. So we also track the duration. You can see that we're right when kids get put in the room for any types of misbehavior, they're usually out of the room within 6 hours. So we usually only want to put kids in the room or use any type of, you're going to your room for things that are crime. So if they're fighting, assaults on staff, things that their behavior's out of control. So that's how the Montana Department of Corrections, I think, keeps track of how we're using confinement and then also compares ourselves to a national standard. So we found when testing our kids that if you look at the national or the population out there, usually only 15 to 20%, it's sometimes even lower, are tactical learners, hands-on learners. We find our kids are about 75%. It's kind of surprising. So we've really, over the last 10 years, upped our hands-on learning and vocational training. It gives the kids an opportunity to learn a job skill. It gets them out of a classroom where they haven't really been very successful sometimes, and also gives them something to look forward to. As we took the confinement and some of that punishment stuff away, on the other end, we added the vocational, educational, welding, greenhouse, things like that, and the kids respond to that. Then if the kids misbehave, they lose that. Next slide, Carolyn. You can also see we have a culinary arts program and an automotive program. So we also have partnership with the BLM, and we have a wild horse program. And so the horses are brought in, young horses are brought in, the kids work on gentling them. And once they're gentled, they're adopted back out to the people in the community. It's a good lesson for the kids. They have to really learn empathy. They have to learn patience. A wild horse doesn't just want to walk up to you. And some of the kids finally do make the connection. You know, the wild horses come in from we get them from Nevada, Colorado, and Washington, and they don't want anything to do with society, but they have to change to go back out in society to be adopted back out. And our kids have to do the same thing. To be successful in society, the kids have to change. And so working with the kids, they sometimes make that correlation. Hey, this horse really needs to change, or he's not going to have a good life, and I need to do the same thing. It's been a good program for us. It's also part of that hands-on learning thing and a program the kids look forward to. We have a restitution program on site. We pay out annually around $30,000 back to victims. And so kids who come into Pine Hills and owe restitution, they have an opportunity to work that out. So hopefully when they get back out to the community, they don't owe restitution and they have that commitment taken care of. Kids are out. We have a fairly large garden. We have a ranch where the kids are out working with calves, branding, doing different things. They clean the dump road, clean the facility, do different things like that. They said we do about 6,000 hours the Miles City community of community service. So, PBS also allows us to track programming, and so there's quite a number of different things it does. But we'll go through, and so this is a percent of youth confined more than 60 days who have completed a vocational skills assessment. And you can see we're well ahead of that national average doing that as well. When we, the next slide, we asked the kids some of those same questions. Does this facility have a good school program? 92% of them are saying yes. And do we have a good recreation program? And so 88% of them are saying yes. So that's my presentation on population and how we're handling different types of confinement. And I am open to questions, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. We'll take public comment first. I see no public comment in the room. Anyone online? No public comment online.
Madam Chair, there's nobody online.
Thank you. Do we have questions, comments from the committee? Representative Smith.
Chair Aguirre, I appreciate the presentation. It's information that I didn't know before, especially about the programming, which is great to hear. One of the questions I had is, you know, you have the programming, the hands-on learning, the restitution programming, the wild horses. Can you tell us more about the mental health treatment that's available for kids?
So that's part of that, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. That's part of that plan we built at the very beginning. When we use that Ohio Youth Assessment, we look at the kid and what do you need? And the treatment team then builds that treatment plan. The mental, if he has a mental health piece, if he needs a chemical dependency, all those different types of things are put in there. And those are the things then he needs to complete to successfully leave Pine Hills. Is that treatment plan. Some of those other things are some of those activities we do that help with things, but the kind of the meat and potatoes of really what we need to do to treat that kid are those things you're talking about. So if you need more specifics, I could get that for you.
Ask a follow-up. So the chemical treatment or chemical dependency treatment, so does that occur? So say you go through that assessment and it's pretty clear that, you know, the youth has an issue with that. Does that occur on site? Is that telehealth? What does that look like?
That occurs on site, here, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. So the that all occurs on site. Some of the mental health, we do do contract with a licensed psychiatrist, child psychiatrist, and so the medication management and that type of stuff happens through that. The behavior management stuff and the addiction training and things like that that our LACs do happens on site.
Go ahead.
Can you tell us more about the number of kind of medical professionals that you have on site for mental health issues that come out of those assessments?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we have quite a few. We have a on staff, and I'm trying to think of titles. We have a staff that's dedicated specifically to that. And so we have three mental health staff, I think two or three LACs on site. I can get you the specific numbers to do that. They service both the adult population and the youth population. So we do, and I didn't touch on it here, but we do site sound separation. So what we do is to manage that is the adults have treatment in the morning, so our treatment professionals are working with that, and the kids are in school. And then we flip it in the afternoon. In the afternoon, then the kids come back to the units, the treatment staff are working with them, and then the adults who have that 14-16 program are then in school working on their GEDs and their vocational training.
That's great. That's really helpful. Madam Chair, I have other questions that I know other folks have questions as well, so I'll wait so others have an opportunity.
Okay. County Attorney Twido.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation on Pine Hills. As the jurisdiction that is dealing with that juvenile violence that spiked in 2023, what changes have you made with regard to the juvenile gang issues in Pine Hills? Because you identified two of the gangs that are operating here. There appears to be gang activity in Pine Hills. What sort of new steps have you taken to deal with that?
Madam Chair, Attorney Twido, we went out and looked at some different gang intervention type trainings. There's a nationally recognized one that we just bought that we're just starting to use. We brought some speakers in actually last week. Some former the department has a group of ex inmates that come around and do a talk. And they came in and visited with the kids. And the kids had a lot of questions, like, how do I get out of gangs? How do I, you know, is that possible? Internally, the kids are having some of those same struggles. Where do I go? I can't go back to Billings. So we are upping that. We're sending our staff to different types of training because obviously we're seeing more of a problem. We've always had a gang problem. This is probably one of the more serious ones. It hasn't led currently to more violence inside the facility. We are mapping, keeping track of the connections that are happening. We're separating, trying to do different types of conflict resolution. And then we'll bring that gang intervention treatment type model into the facility and run those people who are identified as gang members through that before they're released.
Chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
When you are going to be releasing a juvenile, let's say they're aging out of the facility, do you have any protocol to communicate with the community law enforcement where they're going to be released to let them know maybe there's some gang affiliation or gang development during their stay at Pine Hills?
Madam Chair, County Attorney, we do have one. We just put it in place within the last month or two. The director had asked that anytime we release anyone, we're sending something to law enforcement. And so any youth we release, a notification will go out to the sheriff's department in that county, letting them know who's coming, where they're planning on residing. And so that's something we've just developed over the last couple months. It is currently happening now.
Thank you.
Director Gutkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just more of a statement than a question. I just want to thank the superintendent and his crew over there. As you could hear today, incredibly challenging when you have a group of individuals at that age that are more violent than ever. I think that's a safe thing to say, and I would argue that the county attorney would also agree with that. Yet their youth. And that is the best time to try and rehabilitate and get them headed in the right direction. So you have that challenge of they're more violent than ever. However, we don't want to treat them like adult offenders in the prison setting. So I just want to echo and just thank our folks that are over there. That's an incredibly difficult environment, and they're learning as they go.
Ms. Bear, don't walk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent Ray, could you explain to the committee what the restrictions are on the 18 to 24 program, on how do people get to the 18 to 24 program? Is it only the extended jurisdiction from youth court, or is it somewhat of a diversion from DOC into a more vocational training than they might get at Connections or something?
Madam Chair, Mrs. Baird-Walk, that's a good question. So it is, we do try to screen DOC commits. And so they're committed to the Montana Department of Corrections. And we try to find like those entry level offenders, people that haven't been to prison before and they're a young offender. And then we screen for those three criteria. We screen for if they don't have their GED, we're looking specifically for people who need that education. We're looking for people who don't have any job training or job skills and bring them in and then try to do that with our vocational programming. And then we're also looking for people who need treatment. And so those three criteria, and then also we're not looking to try to bring a prison culture into a young adult program. And so we try to screen out some of the more violent offenders, sex offenders, anyone with violence against youth, because we have youth on campus. So does that answer your question?
It does. Follow up.
Go ahead.
Are those same opportunities available at 5Cs? It's not my understanding that they have been, or that there is an 18 to 24 program available for young women in Montana.
No, Madam Chair, 5Cs is just specifically for girls under 18, and so it's a youth facility.
Director Shandelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent, if do you have any notion of the rise of criminally convicted youth? I mean, I suppose we're coming from a COVID time that would be historically low anyway, but this seems like a dramatic increase. And second, if this trend continues, do you foresee any need to change in programming for these individuals that wouldn't be part of the youth court system and would be going into DOC? Is that a different set of problems if this trend of criminally convicted youth to Fine Hills continues?
Madam Chair, Director, it does, because when you have, so the reason we're having more criminally convicted youth is because youth are committing more violent crimes. And so counties are having to look, do we continue to keep these kids in youth court, or do we move them into adult court? And counties are making that decision that these kids need to be charged as adults. We house those kids at Pine Hills, and it does cause problems. Generally, a length of stay on a kid is 6 to 8 months. And research shows that's about the optimum amount of time. You have to do treatment with a kid, but you also need to get a kid back on a community. You can't raise a kid in a correctional facility and be successful. They need to learn how to be successful in a community. Criminally convicted youth are completely different youth in that they're likely going to be at Pine Hills for years. We're seeing a lot of these offenders that are coming in are 14 or 15 years old. And so they're going to be at Pine Hills for 3 years. And so that challenges us as a staff, because we're going to have to change. Normally, we're preparing for a kid who's going to be here for 6 months and a year. Now we're preparing for a kid who's going to be here for 3 years or 4 years.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, can you give us just a little bit of insight into what that what that programming might look like for someone if you have a population of 13 to 14 year olds that are going to age out of Pine Hills through a criminal conviction, what that transition to DOC custody and care might look like, what gaps you might see that wouldn't necessarily be part of the youth court system because there are other avenues, or are there things that you can do to set these youth up for success as they enter adult corrections?
Madam Chair, Director, so there's a lot of different things that are going on. I mean, if the kids are actual DOC commits, when they turn 18, we would screen them just like any probation, paroles getting involved. We have had kids that have been criminally convicted kids that have went out on then parole or probation into the community. We've also had kids that were violent enough that they then went into the prison system. And so it's really based on their behavior, their crime, and their sentence. These kids that are being charged with the homicide cases, those cases haven't moved through the courts yet. And so, you know, we just don't know what that's going to look like. We are going to be challenging. We are going to have to react. And we are going to have to change our programming because of the number of kids to prepare those. We do have the vocational programming, and so kids that can get out are going to come out with a pretty good skill. If you're there for 3 years, you're going to be a pretty good welder. They are going to be able to get their GED or their diploma. Most of them are probably going to graduate because they're there that length of time with a high school diploma. So that would be an advantage. I think they're going to come out. And then treatment-wise, obviously, we're going to be able to do what they need to do to prepare them for that.
Yes, follow-up.
This question is actually for Director Gukan. Is there any transition for a criminally convicted youth, or are they just going to be screened as any other DOC commitment would be? I mean, I think Superintendent said they would be screened. I'm mostly curious if there's a pathway for these youth to avoid prison primarily, but.
And so we're working, Madam Chair, Director, we're working with adult probation already on those kids. And so they're aware of them, they're aware of where they're at. And with a number of them, they'll be able to have work on a plan. And so.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Bear, don't walk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent, and I guess Director Gukan, given that we are having more young adults going into the system, is there specific training happening with the probation officers who are now going to supervise very young adults with expectations and, even down to brain development, right? We know that a child's brain doesn't finish developing until they're 25. If we put them in DOC or in prison, the impact on their nervous system basically gets rewired. Is that something that is happening?
Madam Chair, Mrs. Bears Don't Walk. We haven't had a large number. I know just in specific counties, probation and parole is assigning an officer because it is different. And I think we understand that. And they are, in a couple cases, if specifically just assigned an officer that works better with kids. The formal part, I'm not sure of.
Okay. Follow up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. I think this is just more of a statement. I actually handled several cases where kids were charged with negligent homicides. One went to 5Cs and one went to the Pine Hills 18 to 24 program. The 18 to 24 program was pivotal for this young person in his life, just in getting some skills and having some stability. I am not sure that the 5Cs program was as impactful just because of length of stay and inability for her to have some kind of support when she came out. So when she came out, it was like she was dropped back into a community with no system, and she's 18, right? We barely let our 18-year-olds do anything now, you know? So I guess I'm looking a little bit at the discrepancies between opportunities for young men in our system and young women, and I think we're finding more young women coming into our system and trying to address that. Is there a look to that in Montana community when young women are coming back? Is there anything, is there a thought to develop anything?
Madam Chair, I appreciate those comments and the feedback on the program. There is some, and one of the things we struggle with and the department's been working on and is what do we do with 18-year-olds that age out? And there's not a lot of services for those people. They're caught in no man's land. And so they're 18. If they don't have a family, if they don't have services, they're outside of the purview of the adult system. And so we struggle with what do we do with those people. And so we've looked at different models, and there's one of the ideas came out of Massachusetts, where they have a case manager for those people, and those kids volunteer to be part of the program, but then some money set aside to help those kids get back on their feet with job training, finding jobs, finding housing, finding rent. I mean, what do you do when you're 18 years old and you're dropped on the street and there's nobody overseeing? We know what happens to those types of kids. So there is some discussions and some work being done on those 18-year-olds. That transition piece is something I think that'd be a good discussion.
Director Gutkin?
Yeah, just really quick, Madam Chair, our effective supervision work group is actually working on that as we speak. So, but we know that there's a gap, and we need to take care of that.
Director Shandelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the slides that you put in here are great, and it's a great overview of the programming. One thing that's missing, and maybe hopefully you can just give us an idea, at least roughly, where are your youths discharged, or those in 18 to 24? What percent are discharging to which programs? How many are truly just aging out of the youth system and don't have extended jurisdiction or some other mechanism to keep them with services?
Madam Chair. Director, we looked last year, and I think we had 5 kids that we released that didn't have services, and that we struggled with a place to put them.
Go ahead.
Out of about 30-ish discharges, and so what would the other 25 be a mix of adult DOC and extended jurisdiction from youth court, pretty equally, or is there?
Madam Chair, and so the rest of them are probably getting out before they're 18.
Okay.
And so they're going back into a family. We have a place to put them. Like I said, our length of stay is at 6 to 8 months. And so on that chart that showed the flow chart, when we discharge them, or not discharge them, when we send them back out in the community, they're going back to probation. And so from the minute they walk in, that probation officer that was part of their life and placing them is meeting with them monthly, preparing for them to get back out.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Ms. Tenney?
Madam Chair, just a quick question for me. Do you offer restorative justice programs to the youth while incarcerated there?
Madam Chair, we do some restorative stuff. We started at Pine Hills Park. It was a barren land. It's right on Main Street. The kids go over and clean it, take the garbage out, and maintain it. And we talk about restorative justice practices in that type of program. It's not a forum program. But you're taking from communities, you're taking from your own community, and now you're going to give back to community by helping mow the park, do those types of things. So.
Ms. Bear, don't walk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible with that restorative justice idea, when they're going back in their communities and they're having a specific officer who works better with youth, is that something that could continue in their communities? I mean, you have, especially you have a lot of tribal youth in here. I think the problem that I'm seeing is going back to this community and finding, I think, which is a problem for everybody, finding the support system, and their only contact is their probation officer, right? Like that system. Is that something that could be done?
Madam Chair, Mrs. Bear, don't walk. And so if we're talking about an 18-year-old kid, the trouble is it's a couple different systems. And so it's a youth court system where the probation officer is. When they turn 18, they no longer have any jurisdiction. The kids that are turning 18 and staying in adult, the adult system, are coming to the Department of Corrections. And so then they're going to a Department of Corrections probation officer.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Right. They're going to that. So we talked earlier about how they're going to that officer and you're mm-hmm. trying to match them up with an officer who deals better with younger people. Is that a model that could be part of the Department of Corrections supervision, a restorative justice model?
Okay. He's not there. Madam Chair, that's probably a question that's more appropriate for the director or for Jim sitting behind me. But I take note of it because I know that we do have a challenge and we're having more of a challenge moving forward, and we're going to have to change and we're going to have to react to it. And I appreciate your comments of kind of the gaps or the loops that we need to strengthen.
Did you hear that question? Would you like to refer it? Make sure you're in front of that microphone too. It doesn't capture online.
Director Gookin, my question was, in the idea of restorative justice, which is really important, I think, with young people, 18, 19, when they go back into the community and they're on the extended jurisdiction with a DOC, with a adult probation, is there an opportunity to create a restorative justice model for that person in the community that they came from? I think it's great that you're doing it in Miles City, but the kids who are coming from Lake County or Missoula County, is there an opportunity with that probation officer to just continue what they learned and implement where that is?
Madam Chair, Mrs. Baird-Olwak, I believe that we have our public safety chief in the front row right there, and he's in charge of that group that I talked about earlier. So we're on it, yes.
Any further questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you so much for being here and answering our questions. I know we have a lot. I just have a couple of questions. I was looking at the charts you provided, and I really appreciate that you are documenting the use of physical restraints, mechanical restraints. Chemical restraints, I saw that there was no blue bar that represents Pine Hill, so you guys haven't used. Nope, that's great. Can you talk a little bit, or can you, I guess it would be, the right phrasing is, can you explain to me the vertical chart? So it's got the like 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4 in terms of number of times, for example, a mechanical restraint is used. Is that a percentage? What is that?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, and so you have to be a mathematician. So what they're trying to do is, so we're being compared to a facility in Chicago that has 1,000 kids. And so they use the phrase per 100 days of youth confinement, the number. And so those are very, very, very small numbers. If Pine Hills has one, and so that's not an actual number. I think if you look at the statement, and I don't have it. It's physical restraints used per 100 days of youth confinement. And so that's so we can compare ourselves to larger states and smaller states. It's a mathematical thing. We can get the actual number for you, but to be able to compare ourselves to other states, they have to divide them out by a number.
That and actual so that number would be great, because I'm even looking at, so the page that has mechanical restraints in the second graph. So I'm looking at the latest one, October 2023, and it's a little above 0.3, so would that be 0.3 of a day? Yeah, the number would be great. Thank you for sharing that.
Yep.
And then I have two other questions.
Go ahead.
Chair. So my other question is related to your performance measures. So I really appreciate that you are internally tracking the work that you're doing, right? And that you, that DOC is, you know, as a partner slash oversight, also looking at the work. I guess my question is, do you have a national certifying entity that once every 1 year or 2 years, they come in, they do their own audit, they interview the kids? You know, because I think from the perspective of a youth in the program, even though they're told a survey is anonymous, I think there's some natural hesitation that they might be found out or their view, you know, their views might be couched a little bit. And so my question is, do you have an external certifying agency that comes in and does audit and evaluation work?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith. PBS brings, we have a, what they call a PBS coach. And because PBS claims they have more research and data on youth than anyone in the world, because they're collecting this constantly, they send a representative out once a year, and they go through all of our reports. They interview the kids and take a look at, you know, is this data actually data we can use to prove that what we're saying is working. And so that's not an overreaching agency that does that. Pine Hills, probably 10 years ago, was a member of ACA, and we were ACA certified. We were 100% on our audits. They'd come in and they looked at our policy, and the hope was that policy would lead to practice. And I can go back and show you the charts from 10 years ago, and that didn't line up. They'd come in, we'd have an ACA thing on our thing, and our use of force was 10 times the national average. Our injuries were off the chart. Our staff injuries were more than the men's and women's prison combined. There was a lot of violence. And so we flipped it and tried to look at, instead of looking at, you know, policy leads to good practice, let's look at practice. Let's look at what actually is going on, and then change our policies to try to guide it. It flipped it on its head. It's worked for us because it's guided us. You can see when you have troubles, and we have, if we went back 4 or 5 years, you can see when gang members come in and all of a sudden there's violence, there's a lot of assaults, staff are getting hurt, some of those types of things. But yeah, we self-monitor. We do have the Board of Crime Control does come in and do a paper audit, file audit. We've had the feds have come in and they do an audit that oversees the Board of Crime Control on sight and sound separation. And then PREA, which Prison Rape Elimination Act, touches everything. Every 2 years, those people come in and do an audit and they interview kids and ask questions as well.
Follow up. Go ahead.
What is the, is ACA like American Corrections Association? Is there a, I didn't quite catch how you described it. Is there a reason that you're no longer ACA certified?
Madam Chair, Representative, we decided to go away from ACA and go to PBS. That was when the decision was made. And so there's only so much money we paid because we have to bring them out. And so we brought the PBS team out instead of the ACA team. So,
and I have one final question.
Go ahead.
I appreciate your acknowledgement and this discussion around the sort of no man, no woman's land in that 18 age, because it's so critical and pivotal for kids. And we also see that in the foster care system. And so I noticed the data point that you included in the presentation that was 11%. Is that 11% of the 30 census, or is that 11% of a bigger number?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's 11% of that 30, I think, of the intakes we had that year.
Okay. Yeah. And so I guess a question that I had for you that might be helpful, and maybe you're there already, is that former foster kids are eligible for CHAFE funds. Is that, have you connected with CHAFE and DPHHS? Because they provide, it's a national program that provides funding for some of the things that we're describing to help kids transition to adulthood. And I can share that info with you if it's helpful.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, if you would share that would be great.
Absolutely. Thanks.
That's good information. Thanks.
Ms. Tenney.
Mr. Could you please remind me, if you said this already, I apologize, I missed it. Where are the girls being housed currently?
Madam Chair, Ms. Tenney, in 5 seats in Idaho.
In Idaho. Follow up?
Go ahead.
Thank you.
And you may not be the appropriate person, but maybe Director Gutkin can direct us. I understand that the numbers are much lower, but still very important. And so I'm curious as to whether or not, is there some oversight into that program? Do we have data on what those girls are receiving in terms of programming, in terms of mental health, in terms of vocational, those kinds of things, and to prepare them to return to Montana?
Madam Chair, Ms. Denny, we do, I visited a little bit. So we are involved, Pine Hill staff are involved in the girls from the minute they go. We help set up the transportation that gets them there. When their staff is setting up a case plan, we're involved. And then we set in on monthly progress meetings. We go and visit it a couple times a year. The department goes over and audit it's with its PREA people. And so we approve the treatment program that they are using on the girls. It's a cognitive-based one. It's an effective one.
Just quick follow-up.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you. So do are any of the numbers that you are reporting today include those girls in Idaho, or is this all strictly under Pine Hills?
Yep. Madam Chair, I mean, this is all strictly Pine Hills. And we've talked about doing PBS, but it would be a lift. They have girls from four or five different states, and then there's a cost associated with them bringing it in, and their staff would have to manage it. For two or three girls, we haven't went there. So
thank you.
Ms. Baird Ottenbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is just more of a statement, but it is... There are states that are raising the age of juvenile offenders, right? And so we know that developmentally appropriate solutions, and we're saying it already, the developmentally appropriate solutions for children, even at 18, are more similar to a 15-year-old than they are to a 25-year-old. And so maybe it's a little controversial, but maybe we should consider raising the age of youth offenders under the Youth Court Act in order for them to get a full spectrum and development in those age-appropriate solutions.
Any further comments, questions? All right. Thank you, Superintendent Ray.
We appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Moving on to our next agenda item, violent crime issues. Ms. Shirley and Ms. Weiss.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Council members. And before I hit violent crime issues, I just wanted to do a quick follow-up on information that you had requested at your prior meeting that somewhat relates to the presentation that you just heard. So one of the priorities that we were given was related to juveniles and then more specifically solitary confinement, using those terms. So that was why we arranged for the superintendent to come in and discuss what was currently being done at Pine Hills and then also at 5C's. The other part to that question related to adults. And so the directions that we received were that you were interested in the information compiled by a prior interim committee about solitary confinement and its use in Montana, but you didn't necessarily need that presented at a meeting. So I did want to draw your attention to the three resources that we've provided you on your meeting webpage. One is a report from the National Conference of State Legislatures that looks at specifically shackling in juveniles. We did post the final report for, it was called the SJ25 study. It was done by the Law and Justice Interim Committee, I think two or three interims ago. And then I also posted a link to the actual current, it's called restrictive housing statutes, but that's also related to solitary confinement, as it's kind of colloquially known. So those are available to you on the website. We can also print you copies if you would prefer that method. With that, Madam Chair, on the violent crime issues, some of the discussion at your last meeting revolved around various definitions of crime of violence or violent crimes, and we wanted to make sure that we had given you information on what those terms mean in very specific settings. So as you go forward in your work session and give us further directions about any changes you might want to see proposed in legislation or additional avenues for study, that we had all of us on the same page about which ones we're using in which situations. There was also There were also questions about violent offender registries and if we had one or if we needed one. So we did want to provide additional information about Montana's current violent offender registry. I am not going to present that in detail, but one of the reports that was made available to you was a updated version of a prior interim committee study on, it was more broadly on the sexual and violent offender study. The history of those two registries are really intertwined, so I didn't try and pull out just the violent offender study, but that information is available for that violent offender study. And then as a result of that study, and then just from ongoing legislative work, there have been changes to the violent offender registry, including to the crimes that are required, the crimes that a conviction would require registration, and then also how an offender may petition to be removed from the registry has changed due to a court case and then also statutory changes. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Ms. Shirley so she could talk a little bit more about her work on those definitions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss, and Madam Chair and Council members. Just for the record, I'm going to reintroduce myself. My name is Laura Shirley, last name spelled S-H-E-R-L-E-Y, and I'm a research analyst with the Legislative Services Division. As Ms. Weiss went over, I'm just going to briefly review the various definitions of violent crimes in Titles 44, 45, and 46 for the committee's or for the Council's convenience, and just talk about the context on how these definitions are applied. The first term in the document I'm going to be going over is the one that's titled Terms and Statute Related to Defining Violent Crime. This is also posted on the committee webpage for those of you who are on listening online. So the very first term that's on this piece of reference sheet for you is crime of violence. This actually has two definitions. The first is on the front page. The second is on the second page. This first definition here is actually a definition within a definition, as best I can explain it. It is only used once, and it is used in the definition of nonviolent felony offender, which is defined in this same section. So that when you are defining a nonviolent felony offender, it is a person who is either being convicted of a violent offense or pleading guilty to a violent offense that's not considered under this crime of violence. If that makes, a felony offense, not a violent offense, a felony offense. So that's what this is defining, the violent offense that's not being applied under a nonviolent felony offender. The second definition you can find is on the second page. This is the definition of crime of violence when it's applied under weapons for a machine gun. So this is used in those definitions in that part of the statute. The next term is the forcible felony. This first term is defined and used, I bulleted it out for you in that context section. It's used for an allowance of an enhanced penalty for a person who commits a forcible felony against a pregnant woman. It helps describe the offense of deliberate homicide, defines the use of force while committing a sexual crime, and also defines, this is the forcible felony term that if you look up above that crime of violence, it mentions any forcible felony. This is the definition within that definition. The second definition of forcible felony is very similar. The main differences of it, the one above means a felony that involves. This one means any felony which involves. From what my research, I'm understanding the main difference of those being is the first one is kind of pinpointing one particular in that definition, in that context. This one is kind of a broad swipe because it has to do with a justifiable use of force. So in the statutes, this definition, it applies for justifiable use of force in defense of a person, structure, or other property to prevent that forcible felony. The next definition is violent felony offense. This is a definition that it just applies to under those who are ineligible for home arrest. The next term, which also has two definitions, is violent offense. This first one, it applies to statutes when it talks about the protecting of a child witness during court proceedings. And then this last definition is the big one, as I would call it, in the Sexual and Violent Offenders Registry Act. It is applied to all these different bullet points you see in the most right-hand column, which is in requiring a child abuse records to appropriate law enforcement agencies if a child is exposed to a violent offense. This definition applies. The requirement of a delinquent youth convicted of a violent offense to register as a violent offender. Release of criminal history record to residential treatment centers providing for the offender. This is in the definition of violent offense in the DNA index. Defines and constitutes a persistent felony offender. This also is a definition that allows a judge to order a pre-sentence investigation, which I know is one of the topics you guys are discussing. This also is a definition to when a judge may limits when a judge may suspend execution of a sentence and then limit how a prisoner must be granted a parole hearing or review. So as Ms. Weiss said, I hope that this is a helpful resource for you as you continue on the discussion on the definition of violent crimes in statute.
All right, we'll move on to public comment. No public comment in the room. See if we have any online. Looks like we have none online. Comments, questions from the committee? County Attorney Twido.
Thank you, Chair. A question for the panelists. A violent felony offense, when a district court judge is sentencing someone for a violent offense, is the operative definition that they need to use contained in 4618-104, crime of violence?
Madam Chair and County Attorney Twido, it is under the 4618-1001, which is the definitions that applies to that chapter.
So follow up. So the other definitions, such as the registrable offense definitions, et cetera, don't really apply in the pronouncement or development of a sentence for an offender.
Madam Chair and County Attorney Twido, the crime of violence term on the front page is the definition that's used during sentencing. But I know that part of the conversation the council is looking at is also that pre-sentence investigation, which is where the violent offense that's under the Sexual and Violent Offenders Act is that's applied in that situation, if that helps clarify.
Okay, thank you. Nothing further.
Any further questions? Okay, without objection, I think we can move on to our next agenda item. It's the after lunch topic, Senate Bill 11 Data Work Group. Ms. Weiss?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Council members. So at your last meeting, the council indicated that it wanted to establish a work group to provide feedback to the Board of Crime Control and I believe the Department of Administration staff on data elements for the data warehouse. So there was a bit of a procedural hurdle that we discovered when we were going back and trying to make this happen. So this council, your enacting statute was revised in the last session, and that revision removed the council's ability to form subcommittees or work groups. Usually our interim committees have that authority because they all are subject to rules, procedures, and guidelines that are adopted by our legislative council. But because this council is technically not an interim committee, it is not subject to those guidelines, and so it doesn't also have that kind of blanket authority. Your current council rules and procedures also don't give the chair the ability to just form a subcommittee similar to what she would have in an interim committee. So absent any of that absent any authority, our legal counsel's best advice was to come back to the council and ask you to make a formal motion and vote to establish that work group. We would go forward with the same group of members that had indicated interest, and that was Mr. Shandelson, Mr. Twido, Department of Administration staff, and Natalia Bowser and some of her staff at the Board of Crime Control. I might be missing someone. Director Gutkin, thank you. Laura has our list, and she has polled all of you for about a potential meeting date. So we haven't forgotten you. It's just I've probably forgotten you in the moment. So that's why we're bringing that before you. We'd like to get that going. We think we can get it going quickly in early April, but we do want to make sure that we are crossing all our T's and dotting our I's statutorily and procedurally. So, Madam Chair.
Director Gutkin.
Madam Chair, I would move to create that subcommittee. Is that what we need to do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. We have a motion. I think we can just do a voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Aye. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I mentioned, Laura has been polling the potential members, and we'll be reaching out to you with a meeting date, hopefully in early April. And we have at least some initial information to report back to you at your May meeting. Madam Chair.
Okay, Council, we have two agenda items left. If we want to just tackle those. Oh, Director Shandelson.
May I ask just one question,
yes.
Ms. Weiss?
Sure.
Ms. Weiss, is there any, I appreciate the opportunity to find a workaround to the change in the rule set. Will that have any impact on any proposed legislation that the work group might submit to the full council for the legislative members potentially to carry in the next session? I think we'd like to know that, just given the Board of Crime Control, which I, Ms. Tenney, Director Gutkin, and Mr. Twido are all also on, as we look at what the board might suggest to the CGOC in terms of a structure. If just don't want to make sure we plan down the wrong path.
Madam Chair, Mr. Shandelson, I don't foresee it having any effect. So the work group is essentially a subcommittee. A subcommittee can only make recommendations up to the full body, which is the council. The council still does retain the right to request legislation in its statutory authority. And then, as you mentioned, the Board of Crime Control also can request legislation through the Law and Justice Interim Committee. So that would be another angle for further recommendations to be made to the 2025 legislature about the data warehouse. So you have a couple ways to go about that, including individual legislator bills as well, should it come to that. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Would there be any objections to just finishing out this agenda before lunch? Okay, we'll move on to potential changes to the Criminal Justice Oversight Council's enabling legislation. Ms. Weiss.
Madam Chair, Council members, while I'm waiting for a handout to get passed around, I'll also screen share that for those of you at home. Or wherever you're zooming in, I shouldn't say home. Madam Chair, Council members, so the discussion of the work group led to a broader discussion of the Council's enabling or enacting statute, and that's 531216, what I don't have posted for you, but there were a couple other parts to that statute that have been tricky for this Council over the years, since it was either created back in 2017 and was prior to this staffed by the Department of Corrections. Two interims ago, it was moved over to the Legislative Services Division. And since then, we've just been kind of taking some notes on things that have proven difficult for the council or challenging, including the work group problem that we talked about in the prior agenda item. So this isn't necessarily something that the council members need to do anything about today, but I did want to bring some of those issues before you so you're aware of them as we, as I kind of look at, we're rolling downhill into session pretty quickly, and these might be some items for a council bill. One of those would be to use the Legislative Council's rules, procedures, and guidelines, which is what the interim committees follow. It covers a wide range of things that are somewhat covered in your current rules, procedures, and guidelines, but it also has additional information about work plans, use of staff resources, and when the interim committees, wrap up their work for the interim, so the staff can turn their attention to bill drafts and things like that. That's kind of a umbrella way to take care of some of the other issues that have been posed to this council, and I'll note those as we go through them. Something else that has come up is the length of terms for the members. There have been some questions about how long the appointments last, and so if there was any interest in sort of clarifying that for the current council members, this would be a potential avenue to do that. If there were a larger change to this section, we would also request that you include moving your current statutes from Title 53, which is a Department of Corrections statute, to the legislative statute, just to clarify that the council is part of the legislative branch, and to ease access to finding those in that particular statute. I'm not entirely sure, you know, if people are looking for it in the correction statutes, or if, because it's staffed by the legislative branch, if it would be a better home there. So again, allow for subcommittees. That might be something you want to put back in the your particular statute. One thing that we would ask you to consider is to wrap up your work by September 15th, if possible. That's the deadline given by the Legislative Council for the regular policy interim committees, and that reflects that our attention at that time turns to bill drafting for the legislators, and our capacity to do research and staff committees is definitely limited by that session focus. Again, that is actually something that's covered in the council's rules, procedures, and guidelines, so there might be a couple different ways to get here. One thing to consider is, so currently your statute requires that the presiding officer be a legislator, and that's in recognition that it's a legislative body staffed by legislative staff. So just to kind of respect the branches, our bill drafting manual requests that we draft that way. So for example, if we were creating a new committee and it was going to be staffed by the Department of Corrections, we would, our bill drafting manual would request us to draft that. So the director or the director's designee would be the chair of that committee. So the director would be, or the staff would be reporting to their normal chain of command. And in this case, that's the case with the presiding officer, but your vice presiding officer does not have to be a legislator, which isn't necessarily a problem, but it doesn't necessarily also follow that sort of respect for the different branches and staff reporting up to the correct branch kind of policy. So that would be another thing to consider for a potential bill. And then, of course, it's always open to other items that you have experienced in your time here. Many of you are longer-term members of this council, so that's it's really meant to be a conversation starter. And again, we don't necessarily need a motion and a vote today, but if at any point you want to see what some of these changes would look like, we'd be happy to draft up a provisional draft and get that before the council. Madam Chair.
Thank you. I see no public comment in the room nor online. Do we have comments from the committee? Representative Smith.
I just have a clarifying question. So I'm numbering the items just so it's more helpful. Okay, so if the council chose to enact recommendation one, which is requiring of rules, procedures, and guidelines, would that take care of allowing for subcommittees, which is number four, completing the work since it would fall under sort of traditional legislative rules? So four and five would be taken care of by item one. Would six be taken care of by item one?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, so the subcommittee in the September 15th would be number six. Would that be requiring presiding officers? I would suggest a statutory change for that simply because the commission or the council's current statute provides that the presiding officer has to be a member of the legislature. It doesn't make any specifications for the vice presiding officer.
And that's helpful. And then under number, sorry, follow up.
Go ahead.
Under number two, length of term for members, is there a typical term that's listed in other places for, because it's a little different since it's a council, not a committee. So is there a typical length of term that you've seen elsewhere?
Madam Chair, council members, I think it really depends. So for our interim committees, we don't usually encounter this problem because the interim committees are very clearly established in statute as operating in the 18 months between legislative sessions, and given the terms of the members in the legislature, there is turnover there. And every at the start of every interim, the speaker and the committee on committees in the Senate have the authority to appoint members. So that is just built into the interim committees in a way that it can't be built into the council. Many of the other additional study entities that have been created over the years have an end date. So the legislation enacting the Commission on Sentencing, for example, which was kind of the body that led to this particular council, that Commission on Sentencing legislation had a termination date within it. So the council or the commission would go away at that point. That's pretty typical to our other sort of study entities that you might have seen this interim or in past interims. Any board or council or commission that's operated by the executive branch, you'll see a different range of terms in those as well. So it's kind of at the discretion of this council right now to see what you might want to propose, or if this current version is working fine, that is great too. It's just that there has been confusion in the past, so we wanted to offer that as an opportunity for you to consider.
That's great. I have one more question about it.
Go ahead.
When, I know we discussed this at the last council meeting, can you remind the council when we would need, if we chose to do legislation, when all the legislation would be due? Is that the September 15th date or something different?
Madam Chair, council members, so this is where legislation can get a little complicated. So because you're not currently subject to the September 15th deadline, the council has worked in the past beyond that September 15th deadline. The key deadline for you is November 15th, and that is the date in the legislative rules that gives or requires agencies and other entities that are allowed to request bills. They need to have their draft language to legislative staff by that day so we can finalize drafting of that. And that gives us a month between the December 15th date to pre-introduce deadline. To pre-introduce legislation. Any legislation out of this council is required to be pre-introduced. So those are your key dates, but again, November 15th is kind of a drop dead. If you had information much earlier, that would be more typical of what we see from the agencies and definitely from our interim committees, Madam Chair.
Any further comments, questions? Director Shandelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment in terms of the terms for members. This is kind of a unique body in that it has four elected representatives who are appointed to this through legislative leadership. There's the Attorney General and Supreme Court appointments. There's a list of governor appointments. And then there are named individuals such as myself, Director of DPHHS. And so it's a mix. And I don't know how it could be limited to the appointees, both of the governor, Attorney General, and Supreme Court that have the opportunity to appoint to the board. But there are director-level appointments on here. Just thought I'd point that out. It's totally different than an interim committee in other ways too, but we have three different ways people get on here, and that's just an interesting thing to think about if limiting membership is an option. I don't know if Ms. Weiss, if there's any question.
Yeah, there. Madam Chair, Director Shandelson, you're entirely correct. I think this would be a reason why, if you were thinking about this, we'd want to bring draft legislation to you sooner rather than later, so you can kind of weigh some of those issues. I think some of the questions have been, even for the elected representatives, if you're no longer elected to the seat in which you're appointed, do you keep going? Normally for our legislators, they are reappointed every cycle, so that if you wanted something different, you might want to specify that. And you're entirely correct. There are some people on the council by virtue of their position as well. So, it could be actually a little more complicated than one bullet on a piece of paper seems, but it might be worth considering some of those options, Madam Chair.
Further comments, questions? Okay, seeing none, we will move on to public comment on any topic other than or under the council's jurisdiction. I see no one in the room. Do we have anyone online? If you are, raise your hand. Seeing none there.
Madam either. Chair, there's no questions online.
Thank you. We'll move on to our work session. Ms. Shirley and Ms. Weiss, do you have some guidance for us?
Sure, Madam Chair, committee members. So at your last meeting, you had given staff several priorities that you wanted to focus on for the remainder of your time. Those were the data warehouse and exploring improvements to the sentencing process, especially related to the PSI process. You had questions and interest in behavioral health services for incarcerated individuals, including youth, and kind of a subset of that was a juvenile solitary confinement. And then you also had questions and interest in violent crime issues more generally. So we've tried to address some of those, specifically the juvenile solitary confinement and the violent offender registry issues this time around. The director was able to provide additional information on PSIs, and we are trying to get that data warehouse discussion going. Some of the items that we have on tap for May was you'd requested more information from the county attorneys about the data that they are required to collect and any kind of gaps or things that just aren't working particularly well in that angle. Given that this week is spring break or next week is spring break, we were running into trouble with scheduling some of the county attorneys, but we are pretty comfortable that we could have them in May, so we do have that planned. I'm hopeful that we'll have an update from the SB 11 work group that is now formed. We could do additional work on the violent offender registry or any solitary confinement questions that you might have. We are also looking at behavioral health for incarcerated individuals, following up on that. And then one other topic that came up that we weren't able to address was questions about probation and parole conditions. So I'm not entirely sure where the council wanted to go with their probation and parole conditions, but we could certainly provide initial information similar to what we did with violent offender registries and then see where the council goes, or in your work session, if you already have more specific requests, we could deal with that. So you do have some things, but we're definitely looking for specific directions about any bill drafts you might want to see or future presentations and things of that nature. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do we have discussion? Representative Smith.
A couple of items. So the first was on the probation and parole conditions, and the rest of the council can tell me if this is what they remember. It was something about who they could contact or who they could be around. Was that part of that discussion? Or do you recall what the specifics, I think Ms. Weiss was asking about the specifics of that request. I thought it was who they could, I don't remember either, who they could be around because it was pretty broad. Is that right?
Or was it?
Director Gutkin.
Yeah, Madam Chair. But I remember vaguely us talking about our work group talking about conditions. I think that was more of the that discussion.
Yeah. Director Shandelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my conversation or my question might have led to this being added to sort of the potential agenda. And I think it had to do with sort of the last CJOC in the previous legislature had heard a report from CSG or CJI combined about the use of conditions in criminal revocations. And they had maybe it was short of recommendations, but they had identified several factors that led to recidivism very early in somebody's probation term. And among other things, they identified the sheer number of conditions that courts are imposing in Montana. Maybe one of them was regarding who they can have contact with. And so I think I was just generally asking Director Gookin what legislature didn't take any specific action on that. There wasn't a committee bill or a council bill that came out of it. And I'm not aware, maybe somebody did attempt, but I'm not aware of any that passed that regarded specifically conditions on sentencing. And so I was, I think, mostly asking Director Gookin if there was any, because that was a DOC study, if there was any effort to, you know, look at I mean, it's probably back into the PSI again. And I think that maybe just informed that conversation in terms of what conditions would have led to PSI in the past. Now we don't have recommendations in the PSI, as I understand DOC policy currently. So I think that's where it came from, just that CSG had done this relatively broad look at sentencing conditions and the way they're used in revocations, and that the legislature chose not to take action. So I was mostly just asking DOC if there was any internal, and that's okay. I don't, you know, given the other things on here, unless an elected member would like to pursue it further, my efforts are definitely elsewhere on this list, I can tell you that.
Ms. Bear, don't walk.
I think this also might have come up, though, because last time we heard from thank you, Madam Chair. I think this also might have come up because last time we heard from CJI and Caitlin, right, County Attorney Twito and I are on the committee looking at those conditions. So that may be where some of this conversation came from the last meeting.
County Attorney Twito.
Chair, Representative Smith, to your original question, one of the other discussions that we had at the last CJOC meeting was a discussion about when a probation officer has to increase the amount of conditions on a probationer or someone they supervise. Currently, the statutory framework requires that additional condition to be imposed by the court. And I discussed specifically maybe there'd be a mechanism where that could be changed. The idea being that by the time that the condition gets changed with the motion practice and everything else, the person, you know, it's a detrimental effect on the person. So giving more discretion to the probation officers in terms of increasing conditions of supervision.
Any further questions, comments?
Madam Chair,
Representative Smith.
So in relation to sort of agreements about what legislation we're interested in, what is the typical process in this council? So say, you know, for example, I'm pretty interested in what, and this is again all in brainstorming space, right, subject to the entire council's, right, or the voting of the council, but I'm pretty interested after the presentation from CJI today, I'm interested in very specific targeted legislation that would address the evals, and if there's a way to, you know, have a very specific title piece of legislation that perhaps could address, you know, the one piece of low-hanging fruit in relation to those evals. So is that something I would present to you as the chair, and then we decide whether or not we'd ask our staff team to research and draft something up? I guess, what would the next step look like on that idea?
Madam Chair, committee or council members, usually with the interim committees itself will they can have a motion and a vote if they want to do that. Some committees are a little less formal, and if there's general agreement that they're willing to commit to looking at draft legislation, it in no way commits you to recommending that to the legislature. Sometimes they'll do head nods. It's a little bit harder on Zoom. So however you guys would want to do that, but we'd usually look to the council for that decision of how you wanted to use your staff time and what you wanted to see at the next meeting.
Can now understand why she wants to revise the statute. So I guess I would put that on the table, a very sort of an exploration into potential legislation that would be very specific in addressing, I think, some of the gaps or concerns that have been expressed regarding the evals. And I'm wondering if that's something we could be open to considering different types of legislation on in conjunction with Laura and Rachel's work and CJI, since they've looked at other states.
Madam Chair, may I?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members, Representative, I think that the 872 Commission might have some groundwork laid for some of the ideas that have been presented from various stakeholders. I know Brian Smith, our Public Defender Division Administrator, was on a panel for the 872 Commission last month. I forget. They may have laid some groundwork for that, because the kinds of things that it certainly from OPD as a state stakeholder's perspective would be that there is no sort of centralized rate setting. There's competition between providers and needs, in that we're all of those that, I mean, the courts needs evaluations, DOC needs evaluations, OPD needs evaluations, DPHHS obviously needs evaluations. And I think they were looking as an idea at how some of that could be sorted out there. Not in any way saying this isn't an appropriate body. It absolutely is. But are you on 872? I apologize. I had thought that you were. They may have done some groundwork on that in terms of some of the structural barriers to efficiency and effectiveness of the evaluations, and some of the issues that, if whatever format we're allowed to, from my perspective, is how evaluations are ordered or shared. Who has access to those? To Ms. Baird-on-Walk's point earlier, do those evaluations follow an individual through, make it to DOC or not? We have evaluations that we might get purely for negotiation purposes, but sometimes courts might order us to provide those. There are certainly times where evaluations do need to follow. And the 872 took a look at it. I don't know if they did a lot, but perhaps it would be possible to get a readout of where they might have ended up after that panel.
I know, yes, Law and Justice is touching on this as well. So would that be something we could ask you, Ms. Weiss, or someone to maybe pull out that information, just so we don't assume someone else is taking care of it? And
sure,
we could do,
Madam Chair. Yes. And so I just looked at your next meeting date, which is scheduled for May 13th. Law and Justice, which is also looking around the civil commitments and the evaluations, criminal commitments and evaluations surrounding those, they're actually meeting on the 14th and 15th, so we're almost leapfrogging a little bit. But we could have Law and Justice staff come in and give you some updates about what that committee is considering. At their prior meeting in February, they did have a panel discussion for a couple hours with several practitioners, so a district court judge, someone who provides evaluations on contract with a state hospital, a defense attorney, a prosecutor, quite a range of people who interact with that process. And the committee had questions, wasn't ready to seek legislation yet, but that particular group is going to continue to meet and ideally come back to Law and Justice with some gaps and possible recommendations, kind of depending on the consensus of that group. So we could follow up on that with you, but it might be your June meeting for that, Madam Chair.
Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Smith, I am in no way, I think there's a discrete question here to what you're actually saying, which is there a narrowly targeted piece of legislation that could address some of the default sort of environments here. I was merely thinking there's a fair amount of work going on in this area, and it would be nice to piggyback off it, especially given the limited staff time that we have at CJOC, whatever they may have done. But I do think it's a separate question that this probably is the right body. I was just purely trying to piggyback.
All right. Further discussion?
have a small research request.
Go ahead.
I perked Ms. Shirley's ears on this. So I guess I don't know if we have time on the agenda, but something that caught my attention was something that Director Gutkin had mentioned and our CGI colleagues, which is this sort of the region of 18 to 24 and how it can be problematic for all stakeholders involved. And I was curious if we could get even just, I guess, two things. An update from Director Gutkin on the, you said there was a subcommittee that's working on the sort of 18 to 24 space. If we could get an update from Director Gutkin on that. And then second, I heard our CJI colleagues mention in Massachusetts, and I'm just even thinking a one-pager about some work that they did hiring case management money that they would set aside for job training, rent, you know, and these sort of 18-year-old individuals who are sort of ejected out into the world. And I'm wondering if we get a little bit more information about if we have time on our staff, Division of Labor, just some details about what Massachusetts is doing in that space, the 18 to 24 space, and if there is an easy way through CJI to get some more information about what other states are doing. It seems like there's a real deficit in that space.
Madam Chair, Council Members, we could definitely provide some follow-up on that at your next meeting. And maybe just if I could circle back just to make sure that I'm understanding what you wanted on probation and parole recommendations. Would it be all right if we came back with just kind of a quick recap of whatever those recommendations were to the prior council, it sounds like, on probation and parole conditions? We could just do a quick update on what those standard conditions assigned by the judge at sentencing typically are, and then any statutory kind of limits on those. And we'll also tie in the parole conditions, which are assigned by the board. So that would just kind of be a short 101 maybe to help this discussion. And then, Madam Chair, it might be up to the director, but it sounds like there is a work group kind of working on those. Would it be something of interest to the council to have an update from that work group? So we're not trying to recreate what they're already up to, but you might be able to implement any sort of low-hanging fruit. Would that be something we could put together for you?
Madam Chair, Mrs. Weiss, yes. And I think that work group could work with you and actually cover both.
Oh, okay, that would be great. Yeah, no need to reinvent the wheel.
And that was Ms. Tenney's idea.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Tenney.
Great. Any further discussion? All right, Ms. Weiss, do you need anything more from us?
Madam Chair, committee members, let me look at Ms. Shirley there really quickly. Do you have what you need for that? And it would. So what we're going to try and do is fill up your May agenda as full as possible, and then we're going to start planning the meeting after that. I said June, but I don't know why I said June. It's probably more likely to be July, just given your turnaround. But that's when we'll try and touch on the 872 and the criminal commitment issues, along with other issues that came up in May. So we're happy to take further guidance as well, Madam Chair.
Director?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I just have one additional comment. In terms of, I know that several meetings ago, myself, Adam Carpenter, and Natalia Bowser gave a fairly broad overview of what the board was looking at, Board of Crime Control, in terms of the Integrated Justice Data Warehouse Project. There is now a PowerPoint deck online, and I can get it to Ms. Weiss. It's on the board website, the Board of Crime Control's website. And that PowerPoint was created for the Montana Association of Counties and addresses really kind of specific issues trying to get county buy-in, which is one of the things, as you might recall, is going to be a barrier. But that is there for the council to consider and isn't just my somewhat, you know, not just me talking there now. Just wanted you all to know.
Madam Chair, Council Members, you sent that on to us, and we'll make sure that we get that out to you.
Excellent.
After this meeting.
Thank you,
Madam
so much.
Chair.
Further comments? Any further direction? Representative Smith?
Just wondering, on the topic that you mentioned regarding the mental health treatment for incarcerated individuals, is there an opportunity for CJI to do a very brief, I don't know, presentation on some mental health treatment innovations that they're seeing in other states? Is that something that the council might be interested in? Because it's one thing to talk about what we do have, and then the next question is what's possible. Is that something that we would be able to fit in?
Madam Chair, council members, so we can commit our staff to doing a little bit more research on that. The CJI staff are, as I understand it, under contract with the corrections, so I would want to defer to the director on that, but we could definitely kind of approach it from both ends and make sure that you add additional information about that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Further topics? Okay. Well, if nobody has anything else, you good, Ms. Weiss?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Criminal Justice Oversight Council is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam.
Oh.
Thank you.